Get ready, set, and go.
Hi, this is Brian D'Amato, and you're listening to Out There with Jeff Rector.
You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Out There with Jeff Rector.
Jeff Rector
on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Out There, the show that focuses on the genres of science fiction, fantasy, and horror. On television, the big screen, the media, the internet, and everywhere else in the universe. Sit down on your favorite electric chair, pour yourself a pint of blood, and open your psychic connection, because you're connected to Out There. Welcome to another episode of Out There. I'm very pleased to have with me today a very special guest, author Brian D'Amato, whose new novel, In the Courts of the Sun, is just about to be released. It concerns the Mayan calendar, which is supposed to technically end in the year 2012. A lot of controversy about that right now. Is it the end of the world? Is it going to be Armageddon? And Brian is going to give us all the juicy information. In fact, the tagline for his book, In the Courts of the Sun, says, "The beginning of the end starts March 2009. Boy, is that foreboding. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Well, I hope it's not too foreboding.
Well, it's already March 2. Sunday will be March 2009. Are we finished or what?
Well, I don't want to give away what happens in the book as to whether we're finished or not, but in real life, there are hundreds of interpretations, and I don't want to be too optimistic or too pessimistic when I'm talking to people who are really, really concerned.
Yes, we don't want to be too optimistic.
Well, yeah,
we don't want to paint too pretty a picture.
it's rough out there, you know, with the whole economic collapse and a lot of things and a lot of crazy people getting a hold of weapons that they didn't have before. That's something that is in the book. You know, proletarian drift of things like bioweapons and, you know, advanced explosives and whatever. So
Don't forget about global warming.
Global warming, too, although that would probably take a little longer and not end on a specific date.
Well, you never know. There could be a date, but we don't certainly know what that is.
If everything just boiled. Well, I think people are worried about the Maya date, especially, though, because it's so specific. You know, there's something very sinister about saying, you know, December 21st, 2012, as opposed to some other date, and also just that they came up with that date so long ago.
Well, let's talk about that. How did they come up with that date, and what is so specific about that?
Well, there are different interpretations. One thing is it's the winter solstice that year, and that was always very important for them. They measured time between winter and summer solstices.
But sure.
Probably, excuse me?
I said sure.
Probably. Oh, sure. Okay, I thought you said where, and I was going to say Mexico, something like that. But they did have a lot of different calendars, a lot of, you know, planetary calendars, Jupiter counts, Venus counts, and things like that. And they also had a ritual calendar of 260 days. And the way all these calendars interlock is a little bit like watching the odometer on a car turn over from 9999 to 10000. So they came up with this a long time ago, and they may have been working backwards. They may have decided to start calculating from the 2012 date and then go back to what they decided was the beginning of the world way back in 3113 BC.
Kind of like Benjamin Button's.
Yeah, they did a lot of things backwards and in reverse.
Right.
They were into writing things backwards so that people in the underworld or underworld gods could read them. They had a lot of cycles that would fill up and then empty out, as it were. And that was, you know, a long time ago. It was 439,915 days ago. So they definitely had an idea when they started what they wanted. And the mystery of it is something that keeps a lot of people going.
Sure. So let's talk about the book a little bit. It's a very interesting concept. It's not really, you said there's no, obviously no such thing as time travel, but fill in the blank.
Well, the mechanism they use for time travel in the book is, I hope, something that could actually work. And the point is that you can't really send an object into the past. You can't send information, as a physicist would say, into the past. You can only send energy. And actually, energy gets sent into the past all the time. Black holes evaporate, and they spew out energy in what would be the past to us. And things that are spewing out energy here may be coming from the future in a way. What happens inside the black hole isn't really closely related to the way time is in the rest of the universe. So what they decide on doing is, instead of trying to send an object or a person or anything like that, they send a pattern of waves, which are a little bit like light waves printing on a photographic plate. And you can think of the brain as a photographic plate and the mind as the picture that you imprint on it. So in order to get around the problem of not being able to actually zap someone into the past, they make a copy of our hero's mind and send that energy in a narrow beam through a black hole or a naked singularity. And it manages to imprint itself as though it were memories on the mind of someone in the past.
And that person in the past happens to be a Mayan person just about to be sacrificed.
Yes, they had
what a great revelation to realize she was about to jump off the top of a Mayan temple.
Yeah, a little bit of a bug in the system right at the beginning. They had wanted to get a king, but it turns out that the kings had these rituals where they would have someone be sacrificed in their place. In the old days, even before the Maya period in the novel, the kings themselves may have been put to death after 20 years or so. But by the time the novel happens, or the historical part of the novel happens in 664 AD, they've figured out a way around that, and instead they're sending this other poor guy.
Poor schmuck.
Yeah, exactly.
To his death so the king can live longer.
That's right. So that's just the first problem that our
That's the first 10 pages of the book, which is
exactly.
Which is really intriguing. For those of you just now listening, we're talking to Brian D'Amato, author of In the Courts of the Sun, about the Mayan calendar and brain imprinting and the possible end of the world. If you'd like to talk to Brian, if you have any questions, give us a call at 323-203-0815. So what is the Mayan calendar? Let's talk about that. How did that come to be? What is that based upon? How does it work?
Well, there are two main cycles. One is 260 days long, and one is 360 days long. And they interact in a lot of different ways. They're like gears turning. And then when different dates and different names come up, it's as though the date in the past that had the same name has something to do with the date in the present. So there are eternal returns, in a way. And there are different periods of time, like a Bakhtun is about 260 years, and right now we're in the 12th Bakhtun since time started. And then a Khatun is about 20 years, when the 19th Khatun, and then a Tun is about 1 year, when the 16th Khatun, the 16th Tun since the 19th Khatun began. And then there's a Winal, and then Keen, which is a day. And all these time periods get bundled up in different bunches. They visualized it as bundles of reeds or bundles of arrows or whatever. And as different bundles get completed, the different deities that took care of that particular bundle would pass on the bundle to someone else. So there are also a lot of gods and goddesses involved, although I don't call them gods and goddesses in the book because that sort of suggests comparative religions. But there are a lot of year bearers or smokers, I call them, or powerful people or whatever, who take care of this or that period of time. It's a little bit like a, you know, a saint's day in the Catholic calendar.
Sure. In the Courts of the Sun is actually a trilogy.
Yeah, I am working on the second book. I don't know how I'll manage all three, but I don't know where the energy is going to come from. But
got to start somewhere.
Yeah. The second one is getting there. But I had originally wanted to do it as one book, and then it turned out that was about 1,300 pages long. So my editor made me break it up, and there are going to be some good things about it.
That's a long read.
Yeah, well, there's some nice things about having it broken up, because I can sort of hear what people guess is going to happen, and I've already started doing that, and then I can maybe tweak the not so much tweak the events, but tweak how clearly things are foreshadowed or clued or whatever based on whether people say, oh, that's obviously going to be this, or whether they have no clue or whatever.
Sure. You can actually get some feedback that might help you formulate the next two. This is
not
based
as much
on...
as with a you know, TV show or something where you get feedback every week, but it's still nice.
So this is part of the Sacrifice Game trilogy. Talk about that.
Well, the Sacrifice Game is my name for the divination game that's played in the book. And divination games are played all over the world. And an obvious example is something like the tarot cards. Almost anything that you play games with actually was probably originally used for divination. You know, dice would show the will of God or whatever. Yeah, the Ouija board was like automatic writing, for sure. And, you know, that's a very old concept. They didn't call it a Ouija board. But, you know, in the old days, the shaman or the sibyl or whatever might drink something, you know, suspicious or inhale some odd vapors or something and start scribbling on a piece of wax, very much like a Ouija board, and then somebody else would try and puzzle out what, you know, what she had written. And the game in the book, the Sacrifice Game, is most like Parcheesi. And Parcheesi is a game that was played all over the world, both in pre-Columbian America and in Asia. And it's actually one of the reasons some anthropologists think there must have been some contact between Asia and America beyond the original migration. Although it's possible that they played something like that even when they were in the process of migrating across the Bering Strait 10,000 or 14,000 years ago or whatever that was. It's not clear, because all of that stuff was perishable and, you know, didn't last. But
who knew that Parcheesi was the connection between the continents?
Yeah, well, Parcheesi is a kid's game the way we play it now, but actually the old style Indian game is a little more strategic. And then if you look at something like a mandala or an aerial view of a temple, say from India or from Tibet, whatever, they're laid out like a Parcheesi board. They're in four quadrants, and you make a pilgrimage around the outside. So when your piece clicks through the different spots around a Parcheesi board, you're basically doing this very old pilgrimage circuit by proxy.
Interesting.
And this is Yeah, this is what they had in pre-Columbian America, too. You might walk around a pyramid and stop at different stations and so forth. So they would use the different throws of the dice or whatever randomizer they were using to kind of know the will of the gods, and then they would play against that a little bit with whatever strategy was involved, you know, to try to find maybe a better day to do something, you know, to start a, you know, to start collecting taxes or to burn off the crops or any number of things.
Yeah, and or probably, you know, in those days, a sacrifice, or if someone was put to death, which we know happened quite a bit.
Yeah.
Sometimes, literally, your life was in the hands of a roll of the dice.
Sure, they figured that God would, you know, would tell them, you know, if you spun it in an arrow or something, God would probably let you know if the person was innocent or not. So that happened a lot, even in medieval Europe, and you know, it wasn't the only way they meted out punishments in the old days. They, you know, they couldn't quite do that. But in general, when things were more in doubt, you know, it was more likely to happen in civil cases. Like, for instance, if two people, you know, were accusing each other of something and one was lying, and no one had any idea which one it was, that was when you'd tend to get the trials by ordeal. You know, when they'd burn somebody and see whether he would heal, or throw him in the water and see whether, you know, throw both of the parties in the water and see which one floated, you know, that kind of thing.
Which one drowned, which one drowned, which one didn't, which
yeah.
one burned.
That's... Yeah, if they both drowned, they were both lying.
Yeah, they both were big big fat liars.
Yeah.
Oh, he burned up. Gosh, he was guilty.
Yeah, well, he must have been. I mean, you know.
The gods didn't protect him, right? He died.
It's not great, but you know, considering the way a lot of juries work today, it's, you know, it's no wonder it persisted for so long. But on a cosmic scale, they needed to keep the public sort of half mystified and half enlightened. You know, they had to the kings had to guess when the weather, you know, was going to be bad or whatever, and they had to also give reasons for why they misguessed if
right.
they did. So they had all these apparatuses to do that.
Talk about the research that went into to this book. Did you have you visited the Mayan temples at all personally?
I spent a lot of time down there, especially at ones that are a little bit out of the way. Like Yaxchilan is especially nice because it's not near any real town, and it's not too crowded with tourists or whatever. It's
not really a tourist
a
trap.
Yeah, I mean, some of the big ones like Chichen are great too. I think you should go to all of them if you're down there. But something like Yaxchilan is very moody and dramatic. And you still get a sense of what it was like in the old days. Although, of course, in the old days it was actually really crowded, you know. And I make the point in the book that the colors were very different, and that what you see of the buildings is only probably a tiny fraction of what you would have seen. And, you know, we don't know what colors the buildings were. We don't know what shells and stones and mosaics and things were used on them. But nevertheless, you get... you get a certain sense of it from some of the great sites. Some of the other really important sites, though, are still pretty much just jungle, you know, something like Piedras Negras, which was a huge city in its day. There's really nothing to see there right now.
It's all overgrown.
Yeah. And when you look around, you see that there are a lot of hills, and then in a lot of places, it'll turn out that none of the hills are natural. They're all pretty regular pyramids that were, you know, built, and there's a huge amount of stuff still waiting to be discovered down there. There's also a huge amount of stuff that's getting destroyed every minute.
I'm sure. My brother has been to Peru on many occasions, and And he's taken some spiritual journeys there. And he said inside the temples, you can really feel that there's an energy, a source, a power, as it were. And we, you know, a lot of people believe that, you know, that's where the aliens first came down. And a lot of people believe that they were part of the building process of these temples and the pyramids. Did you just feel anything like that when you were down there? Any sort of weird experiences? Or
well, there's a lot to feel. I steer clear of the aliens thing myself a bit, although I remember enjoying Chariots of the Gods when it came out when I was little. And, you know, it's interesting to think about that stuff, but there are no aliens in the book, and I kind of like giving the Maya credit for what they did rather than saying, oh, well, they couldn't have done it without aliens. You know? I don't know about the Peruvians. Maybe the Inca really did need, you know, help from ETs. I wouldn't quite know about that. But there was one time when I was in Uxmal, and I had snuck back into the ruins after dark, which they don't usually let you do, and I was in this structure that's called the Palace of the Governor, which is this very sort of Frank Lloyd Wright looking, well, it was an influence on Frank Lloyd Wright, and this very big sort of dramatically sited and very unusual temple, and this big owl came out behind me and like flew right over my head, and it was very I would say almost there's no place where you don't get some kind of a creepy feeling. I just wouldn't probably want to attribute that to aliens,
yeah,
or even to some energy source that I don't know about, but I would be more likely to attribute it to the genius of the creators.
But there was a big owl.
There was a big owl.
There was a and big owl that freaked you out in the temple.
Well, owls are very and were very important to the ancient Maya, because there were these sort of just sort of like in Europe, they were thought to have maybe some wisdom like owls in Europe, but they were also very closely associated with the world of the dead, and you know, they're these sort of intermediaries between the dead and the living, and they're very weirdly represented in a lot of Mayan art. Like if you go to the Maya Vase database, it's called the Mayan Vase database, and look for owls, you'll see all these very creepy drawings, and it did look like that. But you know, I think that the emotion you get is attributable to the great architects, you know, and the brilliant, you know, design of these places, and that's more amazing to me. I do have obviously a lot of creepy stuff in the book, but I try to steer clear of supernatural creepy stuff. I think that actually it's just as, you know, it's crazy and it's outrageous and, you know, shocking and everything, and it's as much that as it can be, and it wouldn't need anything supernatural to make it more that way.
For those of you just joining us, we're talking to author Brian D'Amato, his new book, In the Courts of the Sun, about Mayan temples and the Mayan calendar, the end of the world. And you use some Spanish and some Mayan words, Cholan, I believe, in the book.
That's right. Very good, yeah. Cholan was... or Chol was the language that was probably spoken in the main sites that one knows about in Tikal and the other great sites of the classical period. And the Maya classical period, by the way, was about from 400 A.D. to about 900 A.D. And that's when the big cities were built that, that then got abandoned. And that's sort of what led to the idea that the Maya had just vanished, which of course isn't true. There's still millions of them. But then after that, they started to build cities in the Yucatan, which is the Chichen Itza area, the Uxmal area, and that's a different style from the classical style. It's a different sort of landscape, and I had really wanted to make it as much like 664 as possible. That is the height of the classical, or the beginning of the late classic period. And Cholon is a little different from Yucatec, which is the Maya language that most people know now. But once in a while, we sub in some Yucatec or whatever. I have a Mayanist working on it named Prudence Rice, who is at the University of Illinois, and she's done a terrific job with the language and whatever, although there may still be a few flaws.
In the Courts of the Sun is your second novel. Your first best-selling novel, Beauty, was about the beauty, was about the plastic surgery industry.
Yes, it was, and it had a little bit of Maya stuff in it too. But at that time, I was working in an art gallery in New York, and I sort of didn't have anything to do there except buzz people in. So I asked my mom, who's also a writer, she writes murder mysteries, Barbara D'Amato, you know, I really need to do something, I really need to just type something while I'm here because I can't really sketch or anything. I need to do something that's like creepy and horrific and uses a lot of art world dialogue, which I can transcribe just from what I overhear sitting at this desk. And so she suggested doing something on cosmetic surgery, and I was like, ah, sure, you know. So
that's pretty scary.
Then,
have you ever been to Beverly Hills?
Well, yeah, I see a lot of faces that need work. You know, like they need re-ups, and I'm not sure they're going to get them. You know, with the crash and everything, so. It's maybe time for an upgrade of that book too. I was thinking of doing a rewrite of Beauty, or maybe doing a sequel called Beauty 2, maybe a graphic novel or something where the cosmetic surgery was more on a genetic level, you know, since we've had all these great advances in stem cells and everything since then.
So, that's a great idea. Boy, that'd be a good science fiction film, wouldn't it?
Well, the thing is, they kept optioning that book for film and not making it, which is, you know,
it's got to be frustrating.
The usual story. Yeah, well, I mean, it's what everybody expects from Hollywood, you know. Anyway, I mean, you know, look at how long it took The Watchmen to get made. You know,
23 years.
Yeah, but nevertheless, I was thinking, you know, if maybe to do a graphic novel and give it a bit of a shot in the arm would be the right thing, because it's a little bit easier to make a film from a graphic novel anyway than it is from a book, because you've already solved a lot of the problems, obviously. So that's one thing I might do. But there was also Mayan stuff in Beauty, and then that was sort of what led into the Maya book, because I was trying to get all this Mayan subplot in there, and there wasn't really room for it, so I cut a lot of it out.
You,
the Maya were very into cosmetic surgery, by the way.
Yeah, it's funny. I was at a party in Beverly Hills the other night, and I remember looking around and seeing a lot of familiar facelifts.
Yes, they they have certain names for each one, and you know, you people who really know can tell which doctors did what.
That's funny.
Know? But I've always been a big admirer of really good work, you know, like, you know, I was just so impressed with Goldie Hawn, you know, looking so realistic for so long, you know.
Right. So they go, I want just, a Goldie Hawn.
Yeah, I want the
Pam
Goldie
Anderson.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Pam, yeah, I'm not sure about Pam Anderson these days, but yeah, and then, you know, I was very
the young
into
Pam
Jackson.
Anderson.
Yeah, I was talking more about the facial, not so much body work,
right.
You know. Like, but I was very impressed with Michael Jackson in those days too, because I felt like he was really getting at a new kind of humanity. You know, I had this whole theory about how he, you know, he didn't want to be black or white, as in the song, you know, not black or white. He didn't want to be any particular race or sex or age or anything. You know, he wanted to be this elf, like this, you know, this whole otherworldly sort of Krishna-ish being, you know, kind of walking on air and, you know, radiating blue light and, you know, having very little relation to real humanity.
And which he did. He was a success. He was very successful at that.
No, it was great. It was great. I mean, and
he
then
got exactly what he wanted. He alienated himself from the world.
Yeah, yeah. But those are all similar in some ways to some of these Mayan issues. You know, they were very into transforming into animals, for one thing, and they had a lot of facial surgery that would make you look like a cat or a bird or whatever. You know, at least for certain times, you know, you'd put in certain studs in the skin, or there'd be a tattoo pattern that would, you know, suggest, you know, big, you know, big cat-like eyes or something like that. Sort of like that woman. I don't know if you know about this. The Lichtenstein, Mrs. Wildenstein, Jocelyn Wildenstein.
No,
she's a woman in the art world who had herself done to look like a cat, and it's very bizarre. She's kind of a legend in cosmetic surgery circles for someone who's gone too far. Jocelyn Wildenstein is her name.
Well, I was going to mention that.
A huge art dealer. Sorry?
I was going to mention that because I was going to say, what are your thoughts on the series Nip Tuck, which I think is terrific and is based upon, you know, the world of plastic surgery. And that one of the episodes, they had a socialite come in and change herself to look like a cat, obviously based upon...
Definitely, yeah, that one was based on Jocelyn.
But how creepy, sure. How creepy is that? She was so into... you know, this new look, and I've got to redefine myself, and I'm the, you know, the world is finally going to recognize me as this true artiste, and it was horrendous.
Yeah.
It was creepy.
Yeah, well, if you Google Jocelyn Wildenstein, you'll see how much she was the inspiration. Actually, the in the show, I don't think they even really took it quite so far as the real person looks, but yeah, Nip Tuck is great. I had wanted to get a little bit creepier with it than one could possibly do on TV, you know. But I should get back into that. I felt like I wanted to get out of the art world a little bit, and I wanted to do a book that wasn't so much about the sort of people I knew. You know, it was about people I don't know at all. Actually, you know, the ancient Maya.
Right. Well, that's I think you're right on track, Brian. I think that would be a great updating. Your first novel, Beauty, came out in 1992. Obviously, a lot has happened since then, surgically, medically, and everything else, and genetically and scientifically. So,
yeah,
I think there's if Michael Crichton who's one of my favorite writers, was still around today, I'm sure. He'd be doing something like that on that, so maybe that's where you should be heading. That's a great idea.
Well, I'll think about it. Yeah, Michael Crichton was definitely a big inspiration because you know, when I was pretty little when The Andromeda Strain came out, but I was still old enough to enjoy it. And I think I saw I may have seen the movie before I read the book, but I read the book pretty, you know, at a pretty early age too, much earlier than. You know, you probably should read books like that, according to parents and so forth. And the greatest thing, well, there were several great things about it, but one of them was that he managed to do science fiction in the present day, and he made you believe it in a way that I don't think any author had done before. Maybe Jules Verne, something like that. But, you know, since then, you think, you know, one would think of science fiction and you'd think of, you know, rocket ships or something that's a few years out anyway. And, you know, Crichton was always able to make it seem like all this tremendously advanced, crazy stuff was happening, you know, right now.
Well,
and
when I read Jurassic Park for the first time, and mm-hmm. And any of his novels, I mean, it is written like it's science fact. He came from a medical background. He came from a science background, and when he talks about DNA strands and all this, he does it in such a way that you literally almost believe that it could happen, or certainly in the near future.
Yeah, absolutely. The style of it was a little bit was new too, because it was actually kind of dry in a way. I think his editors at first said, you know, you can't have this much just, you know, descriptions of chemicals or whatever, you know, you have to break away from that. And he was like, no, you know, and he turned out to be right. People would actually accept that. He's amazing.
Yeah, he was one of my favorite science fiction writers, and Stephen King is one of my favorite horror writers. Dean Koontz, who another great sci-fi horror author, who incidentally gave you a terrific quote on your book, Beauty, and said it's the best first novel he had read in a decade. That's a pretty nice quote from Dean Koontz.
Yeah, he's a great guy. He's saved me. He's a very generous person. And, you know, I've never actually met him in person either. I've corresponded with him, but I have yet to visit. I do read his stuff, though. And, you know, I think that was so great. I feel like I have to pay it forward somehow. You know, I have to, like, remember to be nice someday when somebody asks me for something.
Well, you are. You're on my show today. This is the... You're paying it forward to me.
No, it's nice to talk about, you know, to talk about what one is doing. It's, you know, it's nice to not just type, too. You know, one goes a little bit stir crazy just typing.
Sure.
All the time, over and over, all day, every day.
It's tedious, doesn't it?
It's not as much fun as, you know, painting a picture, or it's probably not even as much fun as doing a scene, you know, acting in a scene in a movie over and over, although I understand that can get pretty repetitious too.
We're going to take a quick break. Don't go anywhere. We're going to be right back with Brian D'Amato in a minute. Don't go anywhere.
Girls and Corpses, the world's first comedy magazine about death. Girls and Corpses, we deal with death so you don't have to. 4 out of 5 morticians prefer Girls and Corpses magazine. To order the magazine and flip through our back issues, visit girlsandcorpses.com.
Hey, this is Elaine Hendricks.
This is Mr. Haney.
This is Eric Estrada.
Hello, this is Erwin Keyes.
This is Krista Campbell.
Hi, I'm Megan Franich.
I'm Tora Mass Mooney.
This is Ed Douglas from Midnight Syndicate.
Hi, I'm Miss Limelight.
This is Jamie Mann.
You're listening to Out There.
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 You are listening to Out There with Jeff Rechter.
Jeff Rechter.
You're listening to Out There with Jeff Rechter on LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Out There with Jeff Rechter.
Jeff Rechter
on LA Talk Radio.
We're back in the studio with Brian D'Amato, author of Beauty and his recent book, In the Courts of the Sun. Brian, you started as an artist, which we haven't talked about, and then you became an author. Your art was in such famous museums as, I can't find my notes.
Well,
fill in the, help me out
the
here.
Whitney,
the Whitney in New York.
Yeah, that's a good one. The New Museum. Yeah, I got some stuff out there, and I sort of wanted to keep going with it even while I was doing the books, but the book sort of got away from me. This last one took 15 years, as you noted, and I think that, you know, that shows that I kept learning new things about the Maya, or new things about writing that I had to get in it. And so I've been falling away from the visual business a little bit, although I did do the illustrations for the book. There are 3 really good illustrations in the first book, and a few incidental illustrations, the end papers, that sort of thing. So I'm keeping my hand in a bit with it.
You received a BA from Yale, an MA
yes.
from the City University of New York.
Yeah.
That's not too shabby. And actually, you teach a class at Yale, don't you?
I've taught some art classes and some art history classes, and I would like to get back into the visual arts, but maybe a little bit more along, more in the realm of games. I really like computer games, and I like the fact that computer games are becoming an art form, and it seems like the right time. When I started doing computer games as art in about 1991, it was a little bit premature, and the show that I was in, which was called Artist's First Encounters with Virtual Reality, was an important show because it was the first time that anyone had shown video games as art in a New York gallery in a serious way. But on the other hand, there's so much we can do now that it just seems very crude. I remember spending a lot of NEA money on this installation at the Wexner Center of the Sacrifice game and of another game, and now I could just do it all on a PC. So there's something to be had from waiting too, although I would like to get back into that.
You are too far ahead of your time.
Well,
you were ahead of the technology.
I'm happy about the date. I'm happy about that 1992 date because, that's, art is all about dates, or it's partly about dates. Artists are constantly backdating their stuff, to look like they were a little bit more ahead. So that's good. I was not happy about the piece itself in some ways, though, and I feel like I really need to get my my act in order a bit more in the visual business. I had started out painting just, like a lot of painters, like doing regular, portraits or whatever. And then I sort of got into this game-related stuff and Mayan-related stuff, and I found that I couldn't really represent the Maya or the game stuff too well in regular painting, so I tried to do it in this video game, and some of it came out well in the video game, at least the game stuff came out well, but then there were other things about the pre-Columbian world or about narrative or whatever that I found I couldn't really express that way. Maybe if I'd had a whole game studio working on it, I might have been able to express some of them, but they were just things that it took a novel to investigate, if that doesn't sound too pretentious.
Absolutely not.
Okay. Yeah, a little pretentious.
Let's switch gears real quick. Talk about The Watchmen, which is opening this Friday. We've been talking about that for many, many months now. Much anticipated graphic novel coming to the big screen opening Friday, 23 years to get here, and it's finally here, coming this Friday.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I was a pretty big fan of that when it came out. I remember reading it in 88, at least, which was, right after it had come out. And, thinking they'd probably, get the movie out in 10 years or whatever. Now it's been, twice that long. So, I hope that a lot of people are not disappointed. Everybody gets their own idea of what a movie should be, and unless it's exactly like everybody's idea, it doesn't always, it doesn't please people.
Right. Well, it came out for those of you who don't know, we'll give you a little background on The Watchmen. It began as a 12-issue series in 1986. Was later packaged as a graphic novel and actually helped comics infiltrate mainstream bookstores. Author Alan Moore also wrote V for Vendetta, From Hell, which was the Jack Ripper story, which was made into a film, and The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, all three made into major motion pictures. Watchmen was originally released the same year as The Dark Knight Returns, whose Batman comic books would later influence Tim Burton and Dark Knight director Christopher Nolan. Watchmen is the only comic book to have won the Hugo Award, which is the highest honor handed out in the world of fantasy sci-fi literature.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I don't know why Alan Moore took his name off the movie, from what I can see. I can see why he took it off Vendetta, V for Vendetta, because it wasn't that much like the comic book. And I know he was unhappy about League of Extraordinary Gentlemen and whatever, but, you know, I get the feeling, you know, it looks like this movie will be pretty good. So the idea that he would, you know, take his name off of it just out of sheer, you know, spite at other movies doesn't seem quite right to me, but maybe he has his own reasons.
Well, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen was a really cool idea, and I didn't read the comic, but it didn't do very well. It pretty much tanked at the box office. But this, from what I understand, is they're staying very, very close to the graphic novel, and it takes place in 1985 and covers three decades in the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is pretty cool. Well, there's quite a few American presidents that are represented as time goes on in the feature.
Right. The timeline. Well, it's an alternate world too, which is nice. There's you know, Nixon is still in the picture in the 1985 of the movie or of the graphic novel. You know, Nixon is dictator or whatever.
I'm not a crook. It wasn't me. It was Magruder. That was my Nixon impression.
Right. Wow.
Well, I guess I need to work on my Nixon.
No, I thought Nixon was right here. Actually, I was looking over my shoulder.
I'm right here with the big owl.
Yeah, man. It's scary stuff, you know. But I like alternative history too as a genre. I've always thought it might be nice to do something with that, because it's one of the nice things about it is it's classified by divergence date, right? Like if something takes place like in, you know, in a world where Columbus didn't get to America, it's like divergence date, you know, 1492 or whatever. So you can go right down the list of alternate history titles and organize them, you know, by divergence date, and you get this whole you know, nice progression. And I don't think that's really true of any other type of novel, even historical novels. You know, it's a period, it's not just one date. So I always liked that about it. But yeah, we'll see how the, I mean, I hope the movie does well. I hope that something does well in this economy.
Well, it's directed by Zack Snyder, who directed 300, which was a huge hit. The trailer looks fantastic. All the trailers look fantastic. I'm very, very excited to see it on Friday. My pick of the week, is to go see Watchmen when it opens on Friday. Some super fans of the series include Lost producer Damon Lindelof, Buffy the Vampire Slayer creator Joss Whedon, and actor Jude Law, who will be playing Dr. Watson in the upcoming Sherlock Holmes film, with Robert Downey Jr. playing Sherlock Holmes himself.
Yeah. I don't know about that. It's kind of hard to beat Basil Rathbone, you know.
He was the classic.
Yeah, you know, if he can like do it more credibly than Basil Rathbone, then Downey really is the greatest actor of all time.
Brian, we're just about out of time. What would you like to tell the fans out there?
Well, I'd like to say, don't take my word for it about 2012 or anything else. Do the homework. And I'd like to say, watch out for the return of the repressed.
Sounds good. Check out his new book, In the Courts of the Sun, by Brian D'Amato on Dutton Press. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you next time on Out There.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
No, thank you.